Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Food Network Obsessed. This is the podcast where we dish on all things food with your favorite chefs, food influencers, and Food Network stars. I'm your host, Jamie Sire, and today we have a food critic sharing his writing journey from rock stars to Michelin stars. He's the owner and chief of content at San Diego Magazine and your favorite judge on Triple G. It's Troy Johnson. Troy, welcome to the podcast. Most of our listeners obviously know you from Guy's Grocery Games, other various Food Network shows that we're going to get into. But I remember you from your time on Out of Left Field and Fox Rocks in San Diego. What do you remember about your early TV days back then?
Not much. I've gone to a lot of counseling in order to block that. No, oh God, those are my greatest times, actually, just getting started on TV. Well, here's what I remember. I love those early days. I mean, I was working at Alternative Weekly, which is just run on like fever dreams, caffeine, grit, hustle, and paperclips. And we were, it was just a bunch of writers. And we were all in love with Lester Bangs, and we're all in love with, you know, David Foster Wallace and Joan Didion. And we're all going to be these great literary documenters of a city, right? And I was a music guy. Yeah, you know, I got a poetry degree.
A poetry degree.
I was the least employable college graduate in 600 years. You know, I was going to be a dentist.
Oh, and with my poetry degree.
And yeah, my dad came downstairs one day. He's a dentist. And he said, you know, please, I mean, keep you in school as long as you want, as long as you never, ever become a dentist, because you'll wallow in misery.
Oh,
I said, okay, well, that's nice, but I'm 3 years in. He said, well, what do you want to, what am I going to do with this career or a college career when I don't know what I have any clue what I want to do? I'm going to Chico State, the Harvard of the West. And so it's already lined up for success for me, Chico.
Right.
And I said, the only thing I could do is conquer my biggest fear, right? So I got a speech communications degree because I was terrified, absolutely terrified of speaking in public. And so I just wanted to conquer that fear. And I had panic attacks for 2.5 years in that curriculum. Literally every time I went up to the podium, I swear I would, tunnel vision, sweats. I would speak in gibberish. I could not speak. And then one day, I guess my body's fight or flight response was like, this idiot is not flying, you know? So he let's just stay here and deal with this. And from that day on, I was able to speak in public. Anyways, I got my poetry degree. And my dad, it's like this speaking and poetry degree. Never thought I'd use them. I ended up using them on TV and writing. You know, and that's kind of what actually ended up helping my career. So I'm writing for this Alternative Weekly in San Diego, and we love it. But I'm getting 300 CDs across my desk a month. And back then, there was no internet radio. That's how old I am. There was no MP3s, no Spotify, no Apple, no anything. And the mainstream radio could only play 1% of those songs. So those, you know, the artists. There's this magical 80% of those CDs were terrible. But There's this magical 80 to 99%. And I convinced a new studio to let me come in, drop a black curtain down. And I would come in looking like the CBGB or the Casbah here in San Diego, underground rock dive, you know, and everybody had perfect teeth and perfect hair. And I would have imperfect everything else, you know, and I would just have these punk bands on. And what, and then we'd have, you know, some mainstream pop bands. We had Brandi Carlile when she was like, I don't know, 7 years old. We had Maroon 5's first ever television performance was on our little show, Fox Rocks.
Wow. Which,
by the way, I did not name. You cannot rhyme with your rock show. But the marketing people were like, you're young and this is your first job on TV. Why don't you just shut up and sit in the corner and we're going to name it that. I said, you know what?
We're giving you a show.
That's exactly what I'm going to do. You know, so yeah, so then that was great. So for 6 years, we covered underground, you know, bands, had TV on the radio on there. We had Peaches, Jason Mraz came in. There was just all these like underground bands that were coming through San Diego and they would end up playing our show. And then internet radio came on and it was, everybody could discover everything. And I switched out of left field, which was a Padres pregame show.
Yeah, the pregame show.
How much introduction do you need to a baseball game? Right. Not that much, you know?
You really need to break down everything that possibly could happen without knowing what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, Jamie, that show. Okay, so they hired me because they were like, you're going to be the Jon Stewart of baseball, you know? Because I studied humor writing. That's what I did. I fell in love with David Sedaris. I fell in love with Joan Didion, all of the Klosterman and all these writers. And I would write kind of funny, you know? And then I would translate that onto TV. You know, and they were like, you're Jon Stewart. No one's Jon Stewart. All right. No one. I am not as funny as Jon Stewart. I'm not as smart as Jon Stewart. I'm not as, you know, I'm not as good of a film producer. Anyways, so they thought this pregame show was going to be this me interviewing celebrities, having these great chats, and we were going to discover the world through humor, and all these famous people were going to come through San Diego. And then we realized that we were the San Diego Padres and not the LA Dodgers.
And a struggling San Diego Padres for part of that time as well.
Really struggling. You remember it?
Yes, I do. For those, 4 years, I covered them. Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of crying. You know, there was a lot of, it was like, you know, I would imagine that beer sales were pretty good, you know, because that was the best thing on the field. You know, so but literally for that, that was actually one of the best parts of my career because, you know, they looked at me. I had an hour-long show. They built me this studio in the middle of this beautiful historic building. And they, at the whole time, they built it for an hour. And they're like, stretch. Just stretch, just stretch.
Stretch
just
for talk, an hour.
Talk. And I looked at this camera and learned how to extemporaneously talk. And now you can't shut me up, as you see.
Well, as just, we just found out. I mean, that was the first question.
Right? I mean, that's it.
Look at you. What would the scared Troy freshman at Chico State think of you now?
He would be like, oh my, I guess we got through the sweats and this all worked out. You know, I mean, it really, no one thought it was going to work. I mean, I was a nerd early on. I read, you know, and I would write. I remember writing poems for my family when I was like, you know, 7 or 8 years old, you know, and I would get accused of plagiarism every year in school. They were like, no kid writes like this. I couldn't do science. I couldn't do math. I could barely keep my life in line, but I could write, you know, and that eventually was, you know, I said, I'm going to give it a shot. And I was working as a bartender. I was the world's worst bartender. You know, I mean, I got fired so quickly from 2 jobs. You know, I have no spatial awareness whatsoever. If anybody see me on Food Network, they can tell I'm a little bit jumbled. You know, I kind of run at life like it's the bunny hill and it's my first day ever skiing. You know, that's kind of how I've always acted. So I was the worst bartender. Eventually made it as a writer. You know what I mean? Yeah. I made it as a writer in San Diego.
Well, you definitely did. Yeah. That's where you made your name for yourself for sure. And you grew up in San Diego as well. So from going, you know, from just, you know, a kid in San Diego to now the owner and content chief of San Diego Magazine, how does it feel to kind of have this full circle moment in your life right in the city that raised you?
You know, this is one of the most impactful, meaningful things that I've ever done. Everybody I know who had a creative brain or an idea in San Diego for decades left. Every single good band I ever knew, every single good artist, every designer, anything left because they're like, I'm going to make it in LA. I'm going to make it in New York. I'm going to make it in Portland. I'm going to make it in Austin. I'm going to make it anywhere but here. And there's a few of us said, well, what happens if everybody who has an idea or a touch of creativity or, you know, an ambition leaves San Diego? This town is just going to be flip-flops and tourists and have zero cultural acumen whatsoever. And so I'm like, this town is going to be terrible. You know, so I decided to stay. And there's a few of us that decided to stay and see if we could build something culture-wise. And the whole owning San Diego Magazine, so funny. People are like, why would you buy a magazine in 2023? Did you also invest in the Pony Express? Like, during the pandemic, it changed everybody's life. That really scary first part of the pandemic. You know, I woke up and I've been covering food in San Diego for 15 years. I've been helping tell the stories of mom and pops, just launching the dream and, working their butts off in the kitchen. And, you know, I would try to get a little bit deeper than the average, like, oh, this thing is open and you should try this. You know, it's like, okay, where'd you come from? What struggles have you seen? You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, when the bad part of the pandemic started, I woke up to 500 emails from mom and pops saying, help. Every single email said the same thing, help. And I was, because I was the food writer in San Diego, you know, and I've been telling their stories and I had an outlet. They were like, I need to sell a little bit of food. All my sales are going through. Nobody knew that the PPP was coming. Nobody knew that relief would eventually come, you know? So I told my wife, I said, what I do is not fast enough. I'd have to go down there, write a story, get an editor, put it online, get a photo, edit it, you know, and then publish it. So we're just going to open up our Instagram. I'm going to open up my Instagram and I'm going to have these people live on every single day, you know, and we're going to tell their stories and we're going to cry and we're going to, you know, listen to it all. And then, you know, we're going to drive people to, we're going to show the food and drive people to, you know, buy as much as they could, you know, that day to help these people get through this. And so every single day for a year, we did this. And it was one of the most impactful things I've ever done because I've traveled now I've been on Food Network for 12 years, you know, and I've done another show on other channels, you know. So I've been traveling half the time and living in San Diego half the time. And I would get off every night and be like, God, and I would tell my wife this story about this, you know, maybe sometimes, and it's not always first generation, but, you know, sometimes it's first generation Americans who just put their entire life savings, they barely made it over the United States, their entire life savings into this, and now everything was falling apart around them. And then they would call me the next day or email me the next day and say, you know, we sold out that day. Like, you got us through another day. And I'm not applying for sainthood here. People did way more than I did.
But it's all important, you know, like every little one of those stories is part of somebody else's story. You know, it does make, as you saw firsthand, it made a difference, right?
It did. That was this person down the street. That was someone I could go see. And I'm like, this is what I want to do. And my wife said, my wife is the best. And Claire is amazing. She was just like, I got a crazy idea. And Claire's full of crazy ideas. She's like, he's like, I've never seen you so happy at telling stories, you know, of like your own home. And, you know, people know you here. Like, why don't we buy San Diego Magazine? And let's turn it into a modern media company. She was one of the fastest rising young executives at NBC and Comcast. She's brilliant. They offered her way and an ungodly amount of money to stay where that she was. And she said, no, let's do this together. Let's do this dream. So we took over San Diego Magazine when she was 9.5 months pregnant. We walked into a lawyer's office in the middle of the desert and it would smell like carpet and dead people. And it was, and we had a rescue terrier on her big belly, you know, and we signed the papers to do this. We had our masks on and everything else. And for the last so we take it over. And there's a mid-sized media company coming out of a global pandemic, working half remote. There's a ghost town of an office that is looks like you walked onto a ghost ship and there's three people there. And they're like, hi, my name's Chris. Are you my leader? You know, like, I mean, so it was chaos, absolute chaos, you know. And then we had a baby the week later. And, you know, she became a single mom upstairs. I became a single CEO downstairs. And we just teamed it together. And now, year and a half later, you know, we've been able to grow the company and tell the stories of San Diego. I mean, not just food and drink and restaurants and everything else, but the entire culture. And it's working. I mean, in a day and age when local media is kind of, you know, is struggling massively, you know, we've been able to grow it a little bit and just to be able to do it in your hometown and contribute something to where you live. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, and as you kind of alluded to, obviously publishing is a tough business, especially right now. So What have you done to kind of bring it into the modern world, but also just kind of keep that spirit that it's had for the last 75 years?
You know, we invested in writers. I mean, writing is everything. Storytelling is a lost art. You know, I mean, if you can, the poetry, I tell every single writer that comes to my door, read poetry every single morning. It sounds so antiquated. It sounds like you should have a little tea sandwich, you know, and, you know, some kind of black diary that you need to weep into. You don't, you know, it just helps you unlock that power of metaphor, you know, and that's what I've always been able to do on Food Network is, you know, I sit there and I think and I see a dish. I'm like, this is so rich. What else is rich? You know, and it end up on something like it's like eating Morgan Freeman's voice. You know, Morgan Freeman has a very rich voice, you know, that sort of thing. And we hired people that had that power, you know, that had that voice, that had that authenticity here. And you're like, oh, I know this person. The way they're writing feels like they're whispering it in my ear. That sounds creepy. Maybe they're talking, maybe you're sharing a glass of wine on the couch, whatever. And we took what I had on Food Network, you know, what I've learned to do on Food Network. And it's been amazing for me. It's taught me how to, you know, tell stories in a video and in a visual medium that is both interesting, informative, and not too long, you know? And we started doing video. So right now, you know, I'm doing a series of videos. Basically, it's like a 3-minute segment that, you know, Guy or whomever would do on a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing it, but I'm using my, you know, writing. Sometimes it's humor. Sometimes it's adjacent to humor. And sometimes it fails mightily. But I'm using what I have, you know, to tell those stories. And it's been phenomenal. You know, like I just went into and we put that on our Instagram, and our Instagram blows it out. And like, I did a little video on a barbecue joint just in this, you know, offshoot part of town, mom and pop, you know, they're great, phenomenal chefs, you know, but they were struggling. It's a tiny little place. And I did a video of it. We put it out on our Instagram, and I got a call the next morning that, you know, they sold like $30,000 worth of like catering. There was a line. I got a call from the local guy who owns the punk club, the Casbah. And he was like, I have a bone to pick with you. My favorite place has a line around the corner. And it doesn't always happen like that, you know, mm-hmm. but those are the moments that you're like, awesome. I was able to use what Food Network has taught me over 10 to 12 years and impact somebody's life. And, you know, and I'd be authentic about it. I'm not going out there saying everything is amazing. Like, you still have some of that curation, you know, of like, no, this is just awesome, you know, and you need another story. You know, and yeah, so it's been, that's how we're modernizing it, doing a lot of video, a lot of events. Like we're, you know, but I don't want to get into everything. How are you?
No. I'm great. I'm having a great time. I'm like, you're doing my job for me. No, this is great. I mean, you know, as somebody that, you know, obviously lived in San Diego and fell in love with the food scene back then. What do you love about the food scene right there? What makes it so special, especially right now?
I love it because it's no longer terrible. Mm-hmm. There was a T.S. Eliot wasteland sort of food scene for a long time. It was like, do you want to go to chain A or chain B? Do you want to go supersize this or supersize that? We're going to get crazy. We're going to do both. You know, and it really, I started writing about food here in 2007. It wasn't until 2019 that I really saw, like, oh my God, this has really arrived. And the reason why, there's so many reasons why San Diego's become such a thrilling food scene that Michelin is coming to. We just got the first 3-star Michelin. LA doesn't have a 3-star Michelin. Wow. We have one now. There's more small farms per capita in San Diego County than any county in the United States. So our produce is amazing. Daniel Ballou's right-hand man, Travis Swigert, who now opened up a restaurant in San Diego called Cali, said he used to get boxes of produce in Bar Ballou, and it would all say San Diego, California. He's from San Diego.
Wow.
So he said, why don't I go home? Because if you talk to any chef, you can make good food. A great chef can make great food out of mediocre ingredients. But if you start with an amazing ingredient, then it's only going to get better. And our produce, Chino Farms and JR Organics, all these little farms are making, you taste it, you're like, I never knew this is what an apple or squash really tasted like. You know, it's in a completely different species. So that's primarily. And then we're so adjacent to Baja, Mexico. The Mexican influence is so great. Our chefs have learned to cook with fire and ash and, you know, high acidity, because they use a lot of lime in Mexican and Northern Baja cooking. So that influence has been phenomenal. Every single chef here has a wood farmer. They know how to like cook over live fire. That's the biggest thing that's happening here too. You know, and I think that because it didn't have such a crowded scene, you can make a name. So chefs started coming here, you know, instead of jumping in this mosh pit of cuisine, which was a lot of the other big cities, you know, they could actually do what they wanted to do with a little bit of breathing room and make a little bit of repute, you know? So I think the Mexican influence, the seafood, I mean, yep. Right here on the ocean, every Saturday, there's a dock that down called Tuna Harbor Dockside Market. And it is all the local fishermen dumping off all of their catch as they just came in from the water. It is a line of the Asian culture in San Diego appreciates seafood more than anybody, and they know the seafood the best. So there's a line of like our Asian community and chefs. I mean, and everybody, but I mean, it's are just lined up for, you know, a couple hundred people deep waiting for that great seafood. And that goes directly into our restaurants. I mean, so you get that seafood, you get the Mexican influence, you get the farms, you know, and then also I think that we don't over-preciousize things here. San Diego's really casual, really real, you know. We take the kind of formality, which scares people off for good food, to be quite honest with you. You know, I mean, billionaires want to like eat chicken and wipe it on their jeans, you know? And I think San Diego kind of gets that, and it's a little bit more approachable, even though the chef at the kitchen worked for 11 Madison Park, maybe.
Sure.
You know? So I think there's that casualization.
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes along with, you know, just the, you know, the ethos of the city in general. Like, it's just a very, you know, laid back, you know, people like to go to the beach and surf, and it's, but, you know, like you said, like, enjoy good quality ingredients as well. And I think that that is very much being, you know, reflected in the current food scene there. Growing up, what were your, like, what are your food memories from childhood?
Mom had a microwave and she had a car.
Okay.
You know, those were her two favorite cooking utensils, you know, the microwave and the car. My mom always says that I learned how to cook because of self-defense.
Out of necessity, survival.
That was it. Right? And, you know, she was a single mom. She was working, you know, I mean, and it was just like, I grew up, you know, making my own mac and cheese and eating Top Ramen. As soon as it came in those packages, my life was saved. You know, I mean, it was just, you know, anything we could get at Costco, you know, that whole front row though, my mom, you know, because she had a little bit of that single mom guilt, she had to work late at night. She shouldn't have the guilt, but she did. So she would buy all the Blow Pops and everything else. We had an obscene amount of disgusting food in our house. It was the place where every kid wanted to come. And they'd all come over, eat all the sugar. And then about 4 p.m. after school, they'd just all be laying around like frothing from the mouth.
Yeah. Sugar crash.
So yeah, I mean, we grew up in Mexican food though. Like the first like real like dose of, you know, I mean, any kind of food that wasn't like sandwiches, and I mean, obviously ramen is Mr. Momofuku Ando, but you know, it's Japanese. But our Mexican food, when I first tasted, you know, 3-roll tacos of guacamole at El Roberto's, that was my gateway drug. You know, that was, you know, but that was when those first 3-roll tacos kind of changed my life. I'm like, ooh, what else is out there?
What,
like,
is this?
Yes, you know. So, I mean, the Mexican food scene here was just always. I mean, whenever
it's
you
always, came, but yeah,
yeah.
It's so funny because I grew up in Montana. And so when I moved to San Diego at, you know, age 22 or whatever, I think, you know, I finally had Mexican food for the first time, even though, you know, obviously we have our places back home that I still love. And, you know, but then I realized when I moved to San Diego, I'm like, oh, that wasn't really like authentic Mexican food. Like this is, you know, and I still say that, like, you know, just go to any taco shop, any burrito shop in San Diego, and you are going to get like the best burrito of your life, you know?
Well, and I think, you know, it's so interesting. I mean, one of the biggest things that I can tell you culturally, because I've studied this for a long time here, is that one of the biggest things that happened, you know, of what got really started the cross current between U.S. chefs and Mexican chefs. There was a lot of violence in Tijuana in 2006 and 2007. And it got so to the point that my Mexican-American friends who were chefs here would not go down to Mexico. They moved their families out of Mexico, you know. And what happened during that time, it's such a dark time for the Tijuana chefs and the Baja chefs that were, you know, cooking down in Valle de Guadalupe, which is a wine region just about 90 miles south of the border. You know, it was such a dark time for them that they would come on over. They would come to San Diego, you know, a lot, just to like say, hey, we're still here, and to kind of get out of what was a really dark time, you know. And that influence, that kind of like, you know, they were emissaries for a culture that was struggling, you know, and they taught our chefs how to really do a lot of like the Mexican cooking. And that was, out of a very dark time came a very positive thing, you know. And I think that was really a big shifting point for San Diego Mexican food, because what I always say about San Diego Mexican food, I grew up with the three bags, the kind of Mexican food that you put in the riding shotgun and it, you know, it has those grease stains coming through. The bag disintegrates, you know, by the time you get
crunchy
home.
Crunchy tacos.
Yes, yes. But, you know, that the problem with that, though, is because we all grew up on that kind of like, you know, inexpensive Mexican food. I'm not going to say cheap because inexpensive, because it's just still beautiful when it's, you know, it doesn't cost a lot. But the problem was that we didn't let our Mexican chefs, who would go train with some of the best chefs in the world, you know, would not let them elevate that cuisine. Elevate is a bad word. People don't like to use that word anymore, you know, but they had fantastic Baja and Mexican chefs, and no one would pay $25 for the meal because they're like, I'm used to getting a burrito for $3. You know, finally this year, we just got our first Michelin star, and it's a Mexican restaurant, Valle, up in Oceanside.
That's awesome.
So it's a really good blossoming of the Mexican food now. It's not just what we grew up on. You know, it's not just flip-flop food.
Yeah. Your writing career, I think, is wildly fascinating. Just like all of the different, you know, things that you have covered over the years. But you also wrote a book about your childhood called Family Outing. Can you share the premise behind that book and how those experiences that you share have really shaped who you are today and who we see on TV?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was... You know, I grew up with a gay mom in the, you know, 80s when I don't think anybody was allowed to be gay at that point in time, or didn't feel like it. Nobody was talking about it. I didn't know anybody like me. We were the weird family, you know, and my mom came out when I was, you know, 8, 10 years old. And, you know, kids back then were so, I mean, the words on the playground were almost exclusively, especially among boys, you know, aimed at, you know, the F word. And, you know, it was everything. And I, you know, every time I heard it, you know, nobody knew this, but I mean, it was my mom. You know, I was thinking about my mom and I was thinking about what she was going through, you know, and so I really should have titled that thing. The subtitle really was kind of like the undoing of an American bigot, because the whole story was about, you know, really overcoming my own bigotry towards my mom.
Really?
You know, I mean, we didn't let her partner 15 years in the house. I remember, you know, and she was a single mom. She didn't want to lose me to my dad. There's a whole family dynamic that I wrote about. I'm like, this is so sad, you know, because America wasn't ready to let people be who they were, you know? You know, so we continually just were the other kids. And the interesting thing is, and I'm not outing here because it's public, we've talked about it in the past, but my wife had the same experience. You know, she has two moms and she grew up with it and she was the other kid, you know, and nobody really talked about it in her neighborhood as well. So I wrote this whole, you know, the whole like kind of psychosis of a straight kid growing up with a gay parent in the 80s when it was not okay, at least what I was hearing, that nobody, society wasn't telling me this was normal, wasn't okay, and everything else. I was like, it was fascinating, the psychology of it, you know, just praying you're not gay, you know, because I'd seen what my mom went through, you know, I was like, oh my God, is there a gene, you know, everything else. So, and then, you know, just kind of analyzing the, you know, how do you become, you know, wrestle with your own bigotry towards somebody you love, you know, and become a better person and kind of assimilate that into your life, you know, and I wrote it through humor. I wrote a humor book about it, you know, because I love David Sedaris and everything else. And I was going to tell this really edgy, raw, unfiltered take on what it was like, you know, coming of age, you know, and go through puberty and everything else. And, you know, when you had, you know, and other, you know, an alternative lifestyle in your house. And so it was, you know, it's interesting because I look back on it now and the way that I wrote it was that I wasn't going to give myself the benefit of maturity. Like I wanted to write it a way a 13-year-old little twerp like myself wrote it, felt, you know, so say the things that I was saying behind her back or, you know, it's so weird, it's gross, you know, everything else. And so I wrote it like that. If you don't know that context, sometimes if you read that book, you're like, wow, he's really mean. What a jerk, what a monster, you know, but, you know, so it was really like a humorous take on, you know, a coming of age and really a coming of age with me in the same way that America was kind of coming of age and becoming homosexuality was not declassified as a mental illness until 1973 by the American Psychiatric Association. So I was born the year that they were like, okay, finally, your mom's not crazy. Mm. You know, wow. I was really, so I explored all of that and then it really kind of, you know, devolved into like juvenile delinquency and everything else. You know, I was kind of a trouble kid, you know, because I felt, and I'm not going to blame it on that. You know, I'm not going to blame it on.
But at the time it felt that way, I'm sure, you know.
For sure. It felt like that was the reason why any kind of path that I was on may have taken a detour, close to juvenile detention, you know. So, I mean, I wrote this thing and I wrote first 50 pages of it, you know, in a cafe in San Diego. And I sent it off to an agent and she signed me. And it got edited by the guy who edited Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. His name is Richard Siever. He was a legendary, you know, publisher in New York. And it was a really cool thing. But man, it was raw. It was a raw nerve that I just wrote about. And that's the best writing is, right?
What did your family, how did they feel about it? What did they think?
I talked to my mom the entire way. You know, I obviously would never do that without her permission. You know, I said, Mom, I don't want to write a book about growing up with a gay parent. And at the time when it didn't feel like anybody was allowed to be. I mean, it felt like that I was alone, you know, and she was like, all right, absolutely. I'm like, and I'm going to make it funny. I'm going to tell all the jokes. I'm going to, you know, I mean, you know, not all the jokes in terms of like derogatory jokes, but just humor all through it. And she was like, absolutely. I let her read every chapter. She loved it. Her friends loved it. You know, some people, when they read it, they were like, you know, this is disparaging to, you know, LGBTQ. And I was like, I didn't mean that. I meant it to be like, you know, that I finally one day woke up in college and realized that I was, you know, I had a blind spot that I, you know, I was kind of a lesser version of what I wanted to be because I still had some anger towards my mom being gay. And so once overcoming that was one of the coolest things ever in my life. You know, it was one of those like great humaning moments. And my mom, I love it. She still loves it. You know, I mean, it's really interesting to talk about sexuality and parents, but I mean, that's the weirdest thing about growing up with a gay parent back then. Like, you know, you don't like to think about your parents' sexuality. No one does. Let's not ever talk about this. Let's just pretend the stork, you know, but I could not, you know, no one would let me forget, you know? So it's an interesting thing to grow up with when everybody's talking about your parents' sexuality, you know? Yeah. So I just, you know, I was proud of the work and it, you know, we got pretty well receptive. I think we, you know, in readings throughout San Diego, a lot of lesbian moms come up to me and just talk to me about the experience. It was cool. For that moment when I put out that book, you know, I was no longer other and I was a voice for a lot of kids reached out and were like, thank you for writing that. Like no one had written a book from our perspective, you know, before. So it was good.
I mean, it kind of in that vein, like how do you feel about writing just for your own person? I mean, obviously you do it, you know, as a career, as a profession and have for a very long time, but what does it do for your, you know, personal like outlook on things?
I mean, writing is the greatest therapy. I mean, you realize that writing was actually was originally taught in universities because GIs were coming home from a horrific experience in World War II. And they decided that, you know, we needed to help these, you know, service members like deal with some trauma and get it out and talk about it, you know, and it's not all trauma. We're not all bleeding onto the page, but it does help you explore your thoughts. It is a meditation, you know, every day you sit there with your thoughts and you just transcribe how they evolve when you sit by yourself in silence. And that's what writing is. It is a meditation. It's my goop experience. It's my eat, love, pray morning. You know, and it's just fun. I love the English language so much. I'm such a nerd. I read the dictionary. I would star the words that I knew. You know, I just, but you come up with some new way of saying something. That's why I loved Twitter for so long. It was like some of the best writers who worked at like CVS, you know, like these are people who didn't do this for a living. You know, they had an honest, you know, job that was completely different from writing and they wrote better than I ever could. You know, and I was like, God, this is great. You know, it was just kind of a forum of writing. So, you know, for me, it's just that creative outlet. It kind of gets your brain going too.
And, yeah.
You know, you can, I mean, anytime you can, language, as I tell my daughter, is, you know, every new way you learn to write something out or express something, your world gets infinitely bigger. You have a narrow, narrow mind. And every time you just tweak that, you have one single experience. And if you write about it for a page, you're going to think of 20 different ways of thinking about it. And it just kind of makes you into a more well-rounded, expansive human being.
Up next, Troy talks about evolving into a food writer and later reveals his favorite challenge on Guy's Grocery Games. So stick around.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
How did you evolve into a food writer? Because obviously, you know, you're writing about music, you're, you know, doing stuff for Billboard and Rolling Stone and things like this. Like, how did it evolve into writing about food and now obviously judging food on Food Network?
So when the American economy collapsed, I lost both those TV shows that we talked about earlier. It was overnight. Within 1 week, every advertiser pulled out of every show, at least on a local level. So I lost the music show ended, the Padres pregame show ended, and I needed to take a job. And I walked into a very fancy magazine that had, you know, lovely, thin people who looked like they just needed a bite of food on the cover. And it wasn't my vibe. I wrote about punk rock. I wrote about art. I wrote about, you know, and I had a really pretentious view of myself back then. I'm like, I write about art, whatever. You just need a job, kid. Take it. And they said, you're going to have to write about food. And I was like, and really the first words in my mind were not publishable on this podcast, but I was, you know, I said, you know, I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to write about food because I thought food writing was pretentious. I thought it was, you know, people in soft sweaters sitting around an Aspen timeshare fire feature talking about microgreens. You know, I thought that it was, you know, I thought it was namby-pamby. I didn't think it had substance, you know? So of course, you know, I told her exactly what I was on my mind and I said, look, I'll take the job. Absolutely. I want to write about food.
You're like, thanks. I need some money.
Yes. I need some of that money. You've got money. I need it. So thank you. And so we had, at that point, there was the guy that wrote for the New York Times, who was our food reviewer, and the group publisher or the group editor of food, because it was a nationwide network of magazines, had won a James Beard Award for writing about food. His name is Brad Johnson. And he wouldn't let me write about food for 3 years. He said, study it, learn it. Do it, you know. So this is no joke. I bought every cookbook and encyclopedia in the world, and I read. And I can still name. They named the Jamaican national dish saltfish and a key. I made thousands and thousands and thousands of flashcards. It looked like a scene from Beautiful Mind in my little apartment in San Diego. It was. I mean, I'm not kidding. Piles, like feet tall. Of these flashcards. And I studied them over and over and over and over. And I learned, I read Harold McGee's Science of Cooking from back forward to cover. I learned everything in the world that I could about food for 2 years. I went into kitchens. I talked to chefs. I started cooking. First dish I ever cooked. I swear to you, this is true. I said, I'm going to get into cooking. This is when I'm going to be a food writer. I got to start cooking. And I said, I'm going to work with what I have in my pantry. And I found a frozen tilapia. Some spaghetti, and it didn't have any sauce, so I found a can of V8, and I put that V8 into a saucepan. I heard reducing things was cool. That was a way to do stuff, you know. So I reduced this V8 can and put it over pasta with frozen tilapia.
Wow.
I mean, it set cooking back 6,000 years. You know, So yeah, but I mean, really, the way that translates, I guess, to your original question was that, I mean, I studied it, I mean, insanely for 3 years. I gave myself a culinary education, you know, and I went into chefs and went into kitchens and talked to them, and I ate all the time everywhere. I mean, you know, there's people always ask, you know, me, like, you're not a chef. You know, I'm a home cook. I cook a lot. I can cook, you know, but I never worked in a restaurant kitchen. I'm not a chef, and I don't deserve that word, you know, but like, how do you you know, how do you judge this food? I'm like, well, to be quite honest with you, like there is a validity to having eaten salmon 7,000 ways. You know,
yeah,
there is a,
no, there is.
It's my job to eat out at restaurants. And I literally, for the last 15 years, I've eaten out at restaurants between anywhere between 2 restaurants and 20 a week.
Wow.
You know? So, I mean, there's sometimes I would do 5 a day. You know, so I've experienced more because while chefs are in there cooking in the restaurant and really focusing on their own menu, I had to focus on everybody's menu and experience as much as possible, study why that worked. So that's a different perspective that I brought to it. And then really the way that it translated was poetry. I mean, it goes back to poetry. It does. I mean, I wrote about bone marrow the same way I wrote about punk rock. They're both aesthetic, you know, like emotional experiences.
And now look at you, you've judged over 100 episodes of Guy's Grocery Games. I'm curious, do you bring that food critic mentality to your judging, or do you take a different approach when you're on that show?
No, it's the same. I've studied food for so long now that I know how it should be constructed. I know how every dish should have been executed in 10, 15 different ways. You know, and I know when things go wrong, you know, so it's the same thing. You know, the same thing as me sitting at table 4, you know, in a restaurant, you know, having booked under a different name. It's a different world now, but I used to do that. Book under a different name and go to a restaurant and do these reviews, you know, and I would be scribbling on my lap. I'd be the weird guy scribbling on my lap and making notes. It's the same way. I keep that on. But you also you're also storytelling when you're on Guy's Grocery Games. You're also mm-hmm. taking into consideration there's a human being with a heart and a dream on the other side of that dish, you know. So you're staring at you. That was the hardest thing. You know, you look at this person, you're like, and the thing about Grocery Games is that we have fun. We mess around. It's humor is a core thing of what we do. You know, so if we're not laughing, like, I think that's why it's worked so long. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, obviously, Guy's a very talented human being, but it's worked so long because he's kept, and all of us have kept, a very humorous approach on the set. I've had to reach over or like say to the chefs many, many times, I'm like, you guys, you're going to see us laughing a lot. It is nothing. I promise you, we are not laughing at, I know you're going through a lot. We're not laughing at you. We are just keeping it light. You know, this should be fun. You know, like that's it. You've had to explain it to us. I'm about ready to tell you why you're going home, you know? And so anyways, you pick apart the dish mentally. I know the way it should be seared. I know that you got to take the little foot off that scallop. I know this, right now. Anyways, I definitely keep that hat on.
What is your favorite challenge on the show?
Oh, cart swap, without, not even close. I mean, it's like you have a plan in life. You're going to be a dentist. And all of a sudden, somebody's like, nope, poetry.
Like, figure it out.
What a terrible decision. You know? So, you know, it really is like, you know, it's that Talking Heads song about, this is not my beautiful wife. This is not my beautiful car. This is not my family. This is not my home. You know, it's like walking into somebody else's life. Like, what plan did you have here? You know? So, and I love watching their faces because they look over, and some people are excellent shoppers. Shopping is the hardest thing on that. I mean, you have way too many choices, you know? It's like Brad Pitt's dating life. You know, it's just, it's like, you're like, oh my gosh. Like, what? I mean, it's easier on shows where you only have a tiny pantry, right? Or a few select ingredients. You're like, okay, now just cook these. You know, you have to run through what is the equivalent of one of the nicest and biggest grocery stores that you've ever seen in your life and make some quality decisions. You know, that's the absolutely toughest thing. So some people are great shoppers and some people aren't. You'll see people come back and you're like, that's nowhere near what they wanted. I guarantee it, you know? And you'll see some people come back with the entire store, you know? And so then when those people have to swap that person who just went out into the world and hunted and gathered and has like every, you know, Noah's Arks of protein and he's got, you know, the entire farmer's market, and you see the person over there with like eggs and potatoes, you know, like that's it, you know? And they have to shop, you know, swap cars. It's like,
do you guys know that that's coming before it happens?
We do know. Okay. We're privy. They'll surprise us for sure. You know, they like to see to mess with us as well. You know, but they mostly just mess with the guests. We know what the game will be, and we're kind of experiencing it.
You're like, ooh, like, can't wait.
But there is. I'd say like it's kind of half and half though, because there are a lot of games that we're really surprised by too, or a lot of twists and turns. Like, oh, that's not nice.
It does seem very maniacal at sometimes.
Oh, it's mustache twirling for sure. Yeah.
You're also just on an episode of Beachside Brawl with one of your friends, Antonia LaFaso, who we just had on the podcast again. What was that whole experience like for you?
Antonia is such, you know, it's funny about Antonia. She has zero filter whatsoever. What comes out of her mouth has a lot of heart, a lot of care. And, you know, care in the right ways, though. She'll tell you straight up when she doesn't agree with something you're doing. And she'll completely take you down, but not in a mean way. You know what I mean? Like, she'll do it in a way that you're like, eh, you're kind of right. Okay. All right. You know, so I've always appreciated just somebody who speaks their mind, and that's Antonia. But, you know, there's a good heart behind it. And she's, you know, so the experiencing the show with her, it's so funny because she wore a skirt. She's like, have you ever seen me in a skirt? I'm like, nope, nope. It's like black jeans,
you know? Black jeans, black jacket, and a bun.
Yep. That's
Converse.
It. Yeah. She's like definitely the leader out of the Grease, one of the Grease gangs, you know, in the movie.
Yes, for sure.
So, you know, I love working with her anytime, you know, and being on that set though, what people may not see is that it was freezing.
Really cold. That's what she said. It was like not warm. It was not beach weather.
like cryogenically, like I think I'm younger now, you know, because I think it's just like froze a couple of my DNA strands. Like I'm going to live for a long, long time. But it was, you know, because it's beachy and obviously the sun is out and we want to portray the beach and you're like,
think warm thoughts.
A tiny bit of acting in that one.
Yep. She is also one of the very many talented chefs involved in the inaugural Del Mar Food and Wine Festival. And as one of the founders and hosts of this brand new festival, can you kind of just take us through the journey of crafting and coordinating an event like this in your hometown?
You know, it's crazy. It's Claire's and mine, my wife and I dream for San Diego. You know, the reason why we did this was to lift up a city and lift up its food culture. And, you know, we had talked with a few people that had done some big things in San Diego. And there's this epic piece of grass right by the ocean. You know, it's where Alex Morgan practices every day. You know, she's the captain of the women's professional soccer team in San Diego, the Wave FC. And it's this no one's ever been able to throw a party on it. Or like a festival, because there are some neighbors nearby that would prefer not to have noises, you know.
Sure.
And finally, we partnered with the owners of it, and everybody sat around on, if we could get the best restaurants onto this grass and do a 2-day cookout, you know, and the San Diego chefs and the best moms and pops, and we have 2 Michelin star restaurants that are going to be there. It's going to be 80 restaurants over 2 days. You know, it was... This is the manifestation of all the coverage I've done over the years. You know, I've been telling these people stories, and that's what we're going to do all summer, is tell these people stories and then want to bring them to this place. And then it evolved. Now it's 6 days. You know, Rob Machado, who's a professional surfer, he's kind of an icon in San Diego.
Yep.
He's going to do a beach day. Everybody's going down to the beach with him. And then they're going to go up to Brian Mularkey's restaurant, walk up to Brian Mularkey's restaurant and have a brunch with Rob. There's, you know, Alex Morgan's host, and the Wave FC is hosting the opening party. Drew Brees, NFL quarterback, is going to be doing a pickleball tournament. The actors from Breaking Bad are cooking with Bo McMillan.
Kelly,
yeah. So I roped Bo into it, and I'm like, Bo, come on. Yeah, he's like, oh yeah, I'll do anything. Come on, like, we're all friends. That was the greatest. I'll finish that thought, because as you can see, my thoughts tend to go in 9 different directions. This dinner. So Aaron Paul and Brian Cranston, they did their own mezcal, Dos Hombres.
Oh right.
And they are going to do a mezcal cooking dinner with two of the best chefs from Baja, Mexico, which is, we're basically one super region. San Diego and Baja are one city and one culture. You know, they're coming up to do it. The Lodge Torrey Pines, this woman named Kelly Crossan is an amazing chef. You know, she's been working her butt off for 13 years. And they're all going to do a dinner. And Bo, cooking with their mezcal. Aaron Paul and Brian Cranston are coming down for the dinner. We're trying to get them to stay for the entire thing. We'll see. I guess they have they probably have a couple acting gigs.
They might be busy, you know.
Yeah. So this festival turned into this big, wild thing. I mean, it is my effort to use... I mean, I remember sitting on set and I talked to Antonia. I talked to... Artie was going to come, but she got a TV gig in a car. I'm like, look, don't pass up a TV gig for this. You know, we have Eric Greenspan, we have Aaron May, you know, we have Bo, a bunch of these. And I was just saying, like, would you guys show up? You know, I want to lift up San Diego's food scene. I want to put them on a national stage. It's ready. The city's ready. You know, if I throw this big event, would you show up? And every single one of them. We've been working together. We're brothers and sisters. And, you know, like, we're camp kids together. It's like going to camp every time we film. You know, and every single one of them was like, you just tell me when and where, I'll be there. You know, and so it's really, I mean, A, they kind of like Yeah, I guess it gave me a little chills and a little tear, because that's really awesome. What we wanted to do, was lift this city's culture up. And you could tell as many stories in print, you could tell them on video, but until you actually experience them, you know, that's the real, like, that's what people remember. That's what you are going to talk about. You're not going to talk about a story. You're going to talk about something where you were sitting there talking to that chef, hearing their story for a second, or getting a taste of their food and seeing them sweat and how much they work and the manifestation on a plate, you know, and really kind of get to experience a culture. So now it's turned into this whole, you know, Southern California culture, you know, a party over 2 days. I mean, 6 days.
Wow.
You know, some of the country's best wineries are coming out. It's way bigger. It's so funny because we take redoing a media company to make it modern with a child, with a brand new child, one of the freshies.
Yeah.
I would not recommend it if you ever consider, doing those two things concurrently. I would break both your legs and move to Mexico, change your name, you know, and do whatever. It took so much to do this. I mean, 16 hour days, so much work. You know, I wasn't even on my social media, which, you know, I'd really been, you know, developing over there. Yes, you have to as a creative. You know, I stopped doing it for a year because I was rebuilding this company and I was helping young writers, you know, and developing their voice and everything else. Now we're at that point. We finally got to that point about a month and a half ago where it's growing and people are noticing. They're like, oh my God, you did it. You turned this media company around. I'm like, huh. So then my wife's like, now, why don't we throw the biggest thing we've ever done? You know, I was like,
When you're getting your footing, like, let's throw something new in there.
I was thinking Mexico. I was thinking a margarita. I was going to go surfing somewhere. It was both of our ideas and all of our ideas to do it. But it's been such a big undertaking. I will tell you this, when it's over, because it goes from September 6th to the 11th, when it's over September 12th, I am just going to lower myself into a margarita. And I am going to slowly...
Take a bath.
I'm just going to take a
cold margarita bath.
I know. And I told my wife, I'm like, look, no more big projects for just a couple weeks, man. Like, just think that's not. Yeah.
Well, it sounds absolutely incredible and definitely worth booking a trip for. And I don't know. I'm tempted now. I'm like, I haven't been to San Diego in so long.
Come back. This is it. I'm trying to hook people back too.
Yeah, you know? I know. I see what you're doing. You're very talented at it.
I'm all, hello, San Diego's cool. Let's all come create something.
No, it sounds incredible. I cannot wait to see how it all unfolds and I'm sure grows even bigger and better next year. We are sadly running very short on time. So I'm going to finish things off with a little rapid fire round. And then we have one final question for you. Quick snack that you love.
Oh, am I cooking it or am I?
Either way, it's up to you.
Okay. Can I say brands?
Sure.
Okay. Bitchin' Sauce.
Oh.
Bitchin' Sauce. Oh my gosh. A 3-star Michelin chef told me he eats Bitchin' Sauce all day and I'd never even tried it. So I went to start trying it. It's my life now. I will just take those gluten-free crackers from Milton's and I'll dip them in a Bitchin' Sauce and I'll eat those all day long. If I'm cooking it, usually what I do is I'm kind of like a nerd, but I love sauteed veggies. I'll just saute like something really quick, like squash or something like that, or even mushrooms, and just saute them with olive oil, butter, za'atar.
That's your snack.
That's my snack. It's not that high. It's quick. I know.
Best part about being a dad?
Best part about being a dad is seeing joy come alive. I mean, the unfettered joy. There is no baggage on that. Jasper's our son. You see him running at the ocean every single morning. So we live by the beach. We pay way too much money. We can't afford it, but it's fine. you know, but we take him down to the beach almost every day and he runs into that water. His life is complete. You've never seen such joy in a human being, you know, and just being able to, you know, you learn how to spend your life taking care of yourself and then you know, get to translate it and taking care of somebody else. It's an honor. It's amazing.
Wow. I love that. Favorite Afghan food?
Oh, Afghan food. My daughter's a Afghan. My ex was Afghan. I'm not. So we call her Afghan. It's got to be... Osh is a soup that uses a lot of cilantro and ground beef, and it's udon noodles. It is, and yogurt. Oh, it's so good. Or taidagi. Taidagi is this rice dish that, you know, they make. And what you do is you leave the rice in the bottom of the pan and it just kind of crisps up and browns. It gets all the butter and the salt and everything else. You turn the rice over. You get out the rice for the dish and you turn the rice over and it's just like It's like the best movie popcorn you've ever had. It's crunchy and brown, salty and buttery. Oh, it's the best.
That sounds incredible. I have not tried that, but putting it on the list.
Put it on the list.
Favorite San Diego activity?
Fighting off mediocrity. No, I love San Diego so much, but sometimes people come here and they're like, you know what? Life's over. Let's just lean into the beach. I'm like, no, let's still create culture. I'm surfing for sure. I grew up surfing. Mm. You know, I was like 13 years old. I got in that water. And when you get in that water and, you know, you're just floating and nothing's blooping or bleeping, the to-do list is nowhere nearby. And you're just staring at this undulating water and there's dolphins right over there to your left. You've got sun. You've got those negative ions, and then you're just floating on this moving piece of nature. There's a reason why we're all such weirdos about it. It definitely is a religious experience, and it's possibly why I stayed in San Diego.
Wow, I mean, it's a good reason to stay.
Culture, yes. My wife and my children, for sure.
Of course.
You know, but also surfing. Yeah.
Also surfing. Yeah, yeah. You're making me miss San Diego a lot in this interview. But last question for you, and we ask everybody this at the end of all of our Food Network Obsessed interviews, and that is, what would be on the menu for your perfect food day? So we want you to take us through, you know, the progression, breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert. You can throw in some, you know, sauteed vegetable snacks if you need to. There's no rules. You can travel, time travel, spend as much money as you want. Anybody could cook these meals. It's your day. We want to hear your perfect food day.
Okay, so my perfect food day would have to start with some kind of breakfast tapas, because you can't just choose one.
You got to have like a couple of things for the table, right?
Absolutely. You know, I don't have good enough teeth to call it brunch, you know, but I do appreciate the concept of having a lot of things to eat. So I think I'd, you know, like some kind of a kimchi hash, some kind of hash, potatoes, eggs, cheese, meats, and then like a kimchi or something like that to tweak it. Fruity Pebbles and ice cold milk. just, I'm a kid who grew up on sugar cereal. Yeah. And apparently in the 70s and the apparently in the 70s and 80s, and nobody had heard about like, what am I do to our attention and our ability to hold it. But I mean, I love that. You know why I love Fruity Pebbles? Because I believe it is actually Makrut lime leaf. Makrut lime leaf is also one of my favorite foods because I love Thai food. I think the same flavor of Makrut lime leaf is in Fruity Pebbles. I'm almost certain of it. Richard Blaze and I totally agree. So anyways, that and ice cold milk, like a sip of a smoothie. I make this weird smoothie every single morning. It's got every antioxidant and every anti-inflammatory food that you could ever make in the world. No one likes it except my wife and I, but it's delicious. Short rib Benedict. Then lunch, it'd be tacos and sushi.
Okay. Both in San Diego, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Yeah. You would be a quesadilla taco, you know, mm-hmm. one of those. Just, I mean, you melt all the cheese on it. Nobody can see me right now, but I'm doing the melted cheese face, you know, and then you get that birria, that slow cooked meat on there, and just some onion, cilantro, everything else. And then sushi, because it's that clean. I feel like if you eat that, you actually get, you levitate a little bit. You know, it's the cleanest food you possibly can. So it's not going to, that'll kind of like get me back on the rest of my day.
So it like balances you out. From the quesadillas and the tacos.
Yes. And then, you know, at some point in there definitely would be I'm such a white wine guy. I would have so much Sauvignon Blanc.
Definitely. It's your perfect food day. You have to.
Absolutely. I mean, not too much. Drink responsibly. But I mean, I would definitely have some Sauvignon Blanc. It's crisp. It's refreshing. I've leaned into that aspect of myself. And then for dinner, drunken noodles with duck and Penang curry. The Thai food is probably my weakness. I love it. I cook Penang curry. I make it from scratch in a mortar and pestle. It's my one dish. Everybody makes fun of it. Me for it on Food Network. They're like, oh, what's Troy going to make? Penang curry. You know? So, but that drunken noodles with duck and Penang curry, just a Thai dinner would be great. And then I'm going to finish the day in a mountain of cheese. You
know, that's my kind of dessert too.
Right. I mean, I remember when somebody first told me that you can have cheese for dessert, and I was like, this is a ripoff. I'm a born and raised American, and I deserve 70,000 calories and more sugar than any human being should ingest. I just want a plate of sugar. And I was like, all right, I'll eat this cheese. And it transformed my life. I mean, I want all the blues and the stinky triple creams and everything else. It's just, you know, like a fork and some hot honey and a little bit of thick, you know, cured meats. and then send me off.
It sounds absolutely perfect. And I am so excited to see everything that we just talked about unfold a little bit more. But thank you so much for taking the time and sharing a little bit of it with us here on Food Network Obsessed.
All I want to say is thank you so much for having me on. You're a joy. No one could see you during this podcast, but you have a very like nice face. Oh, like you just, thank you. You're like, I just like you. You just look at it, you're like, I can talk to this person. No, so, anyways, come back to San Diego.
I'm going to. I was going to say that is the highest compliment that I could receive. So thank you very much. I will definitely make it back to San Diego and I will let you know when that happens.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
You can follow Troy on Instagram at Hey Troy Johnson and make sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a thing. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review. We love it when you do that. That's all for now. We'll catch you foodies next Friday.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.